Today in Studio 360, was there ever a band that was more sheer fun than the B-52s?
There's something, you know, just about all of us coming together that created this sort of genie in a bottle blend that when it exploded, it was just unique.
Kate Pearson has been singing with the B-52s for almost 40 years. Now she's finally striking out on her own as well.
Oh, I just want to work more. And it's also been something I've wanted to do all my life.
She'll perform some of her new songs live right here for us. And I'll talk with the poet Claudia Rankine.
Poetry allows us into feeling, and it's the one place that you can, you know, you can say, I feel bad.
Her new book is a bracing look at what everyday racism feels like. I'm Kurt Anderson. That and much more is ahead today in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. But first, the National Book Critics Circle recently announced its nominations for last year's Best Books. And for the first time ever, a book was nominated in two different categories, poetry and criticism. The book is Citizen, an American Lyric by Claudia Rankine. Citizen is full of beautiful and smart writing, and it's a memorably searing critique of how race works in America, what everyday prejudice feels like here in the 21st century. Which, of course, could not be more timely given the killings of Michael Brown and Eric Garner. Claudia Rankine is here with me now. Claudia, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
And let me ask you about the title. Why Citizen?
Why Citizen? Because we're talking about a kind of equality, and that's the one place that you take it for granted. One thinks, one hopes that when you step out in that role, with that identity, with that passport,
That overrides that, racial
that
distinctions.
It overrides racial distinctions, you know, sexual, gender,
yep.
All of those things.
Yeah. The book opens with this series of these vignettes of racism playing out in everyday life, some of them tiny and subtle, some of them larger and overt. Did you sort of make a collection of those over the years and then use them in this work?
A collection in the sense that they were collected in my body, some of them, you know.
You mean they happened to you?
They happened to me.
Yeah.
But in the last few years, I actually did a kind of archival thing where I went around to friends and said, tell me a story where you were interacting with another person of a different race, and suddenly you understood that what was happening, was happening because you were black. And so some of these stories were collected in the last couple of years, in the last few years.
Huh. Would you read one of those stories for us from the book?
Sure. You're in the dark, in the car, watching the black tarred street being swallowed by speed. He tells you his dean is making him hire a person of color, though there are so many great writers out there. You think maybe this is an experiment and you are being tested or retroactively insulted, or you have done something that communicates this is an okay conversation to be having. Why do you feel comfortable saying this to me? You wish the light would turn red or a police siren would go off, or you could slam on the brakes, slam into the car ahead of you, fly forward so quickly both your faces would suddenly be exposed to the wind. As usual, you drive straight through the moment with the expected backing off of what was previously said. It is not only that confrontation is headache-producing, it is also that you have a destination that doesn't include acting like this moment isn't inhabitable, hasn't happened before, and the before isn't part of the now, as the night darkens and the time shortens between where we are and where we are going.
That's Claudia Rankine reading a poem from her book, Citizen. The reader is addressed in many of your pieces as you. And as I was reading that, each time I thought, ooh, she means me, a white person reading the book. Was that the intent?
The intent was that it could be anybody, so that one would have to think about what that you was pointing at and whether or not you could fit it, whether or not you could fill it. So I tried to have the pieces shift a little bit So that it wasn't always clearly the white body or the black body or the female body or the male body, etc.
You also refer to the killings of Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown in this book. Is it clear to you that there's a connection between these microaggressions, these smaller moments of casual racism that you write about, and these killings of black men by police, and in Trayvon Martin's case, a kind of quasi-policeman?
I think so. And I think it's partly because if on a day-to-day level one systematically believes that what is in front of them is not a human being, then you put that person in a position of power on a jury, organizing Katrina evacuations, or you arm that fear and call it policing, then you're going to get these kind of explosive events. So that when you have someone like Darren Wilson saying, "What I saw was a demon."
The officer in Ferguson who shot Michael Brown.
Exactly. You know, you just ask him a question and he will give it back to you. He will say, "Yes, my imagination told me not that there was a 18-year-old guy acting out, but that there was a demon who in my reference was as Hulk Hogan coming to get me."
Yeah. And that to you is on a spectrum, at an end of the spectrum, and on the other end is some guy not seeing you in line at a drugstore and just cutting in.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, you know, because I need a way to understand both things, both the micro and the macro aggressions, and I can't believe that they're not in some way connected.
Uh-huh. And what can the kind of writing you do and poetry, let's call it poetry, due to unlock and illuminate those kinds of issues that, say, simply a prose essay can't?
Well, I think because the poetry allows us into feeling, into the realm of feeling, and it's the one place that you can, you know, you can say, "I feel bad." That genre does hold that, and I love poetry for that. That feeling is as important as perception and description.
We've now had an African-American president for 6 years. That's a good thing. Does the killing of these men and the wider injustice that those killings may represent erase your sense of the progress of the Obama era?
No, it doesn't erase it. I think it's incredibly important that Americans came out and voted for Barack Obama. But one of the things that's been fascinating to me during the last 6 years, watching the ways in which microaggressions have wheeled themselves even at the president, you know, just like being the president doesn't shield you from these things.
Like, what's an example of that that has struck you?
Well, from the very beginning, even before he was president, when Hillary said, you know, Hillary Clinton said, "I refuse to drop out of the primary because he might be assassinated." I mean, who says that to their running mate, about their running mate?
Well, there was Joe Biden when they were both running, and he said, "Yeah, he's a very clean and articulate guy."
Yeah, there was also that. Then there was Roberts in the Supreme Court forgetting how to inaugurate the president. And so it had to be redone.
Do you think that had to do with Obama's race?
I don't know. But when else have we had to do it again?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you forget the words that inaugurates the president?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. This is the thing.
You're so touchy.
Yeah.
But, in all of the flavors of conversation that have been provoked by Obama's presidency, by these deaths and Republicans like Rand Paul taking on ideas of criminal justice reform, it seems like, you know, if conversation and fairly frank conversation about race is a good thing in America, this hasn't been a terrible few years.
No, I think that's one of the things that has been heartening, actually. that we have had conversation. I actually have been very happy. Can I use that word?
You may. Please. Be happy.
With the response of the media to what went on in terms of the lack of indictments. So I feel like people are showing up. People are showing up and they're discussing these issues and they're discussing the complexity of the issues. And I think in that sense, what we want is conversation. You know, part of the problem is that a lot of these things have been let go, not discussed, not looked at, and so they continue.
Claudia Rankine, this conversation with you has been my absolute pleasure. Thank you very much. And I look forward to reading your next piece of work.
Thank you very much for having me.
Claudia Rankine's newest book is called Citizen, An American Lyric. It is up for 2 National Book Critics Circle Awards next month. And next weekend, the movie Whiplash is up for 4 Oscars, including Best Picture. One of the 2 lead characters is a demanding, terrifying, impossible music teacher.
Start counting.
5, 6, 7.
In 4, damn it! Look at me!
I wanted the role to feel like, you know, when you see Ben Kingsley in Sexy Beast and you're kind of like, oh, Gandhi is going off the rails. What is going on?
We'll hear from the director of Whiplash, Damien Chazelle. That's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson.
And the Oscar goes to...
Yeah, I am kind of speechless.
You like me right now. You like me.
I'm not ashamed. I love watching the Oscars every year. I never miss them the way normal Americans never miss the Super Bowl. The fact that the award ceremony is this ritualized self-parody as well is part of the fun. You can't know ahead of time who's going to swear or say something idiotic, but you know somebody will. We here at Studio 360 live for that, so much so that we've turned it into a massively multiplayer interactive bingo game. Instead of squares for B9 or N27, our squares say things like, puts on glasses for teleprompter, or tells kids to go to bed. So play awards bingo with us on Oscar night, Sunday the 22nd. You can download a bingo card from our website or play right on your computer or phone. We've got everything you need to make the Oscars interactive at studio360.org/bingo.
I thank you for really making me feel...
I love it up here.
Another thing I like about the Oscars is when a movie by some unknown starts small, gets momentum, and winds up a serious contender for the biggest awards. Damien Chazelle had made just 1 obscure film and was still in his 20s when he directed Whiplash. Now it's up for Best Picture and 3 other Academy Awards. Whiplash may or may not win, but it seems pretty clear. A filmmaking star is born. Whiplash is about a jazz student's virtually S&M relationship with his music teacher, who is inspiring and crazily demanding.
I push people beyond what's expected of them. I believe that is an absolute necessity.
Studio 360's Sean Ramasvaram spoke with Damien Chazelle for an episode of our podcast, Sideshow.
So I saw Whiplash this week. That night, I went out with a friend who loves going to see movies, and I told him that I saw a perfect movie made by a 29-year-old, and his reaction was, well, that guy. Do you get that a lot?
I love your friend.
I'll tell him. Maybe he'll hate you less.
I'm that same kind of person, though. I get very competitive and angry, which I guess is all the stuff you see in the movie. So
yeah.
I sympathize.
Okay, good. If you're not 29 and Whiplash doesn't make you feel bad about yourself, it's still going to scare the hell out of you. It's about jazz, but only in the way that The Social Network was a movie about Facebook. It's really about passion and ambition and how too much of the two can make you a crazy person. All this plays out through a really abusive relationship between a student and his teacher at a Juilliard-type school, and it's bloodier than the Dark Knight trilogy. Damien Chazelle was a jazz drummer in his teens. The screenplay is loosely inspired by his experience, but the real trauma that made Damien who he is, that was all dad.
Once my friend and I, we spent about a day or so choreographing a fight scene that we were going to do, you know, in a single take, and we were just really, really amped up about it. And so then my dad comes to shoot the scene for us, and he shoots it on the video camera. We do our whole fight. It's stunning. It's really a stunning fight that we pull off. And then I watch the tape. I guess it was a VHS tape or whatever of it afterwards, and I realized that my dad had decided at the very beginning of the fight to zoom in on a Bugs Bunny doll in the room during the entire fight. So you hear me and my friend doing our 2-minute masterpiece, but all you see is the Bugs Bunny smiling with its dead eyes.
Was that some like hard taught lesson that he was?
I wonder if it was. I think he just wasn't really thinking, but I think he just liked the Bugs Bunny doll. But
not a director by trade.
Maybe that was the brilliant. You know, that was the brilliant move.
Avant garde fight scene.
Whatever it was, that I think was the thing that pushed me to finally go, okay, I have to learn how to use this camera so that I can not rely on other people.
Was there a movie, like one movie that made you want to make movies, or was it just a bunch of stuff you saw when you were a kid?
Yeah, I never had that one kind of experience because I don't remember ever wanting to do anything else but make movies. So for a while, a lot of my ideas of movie making were actually animation, and I was drawing a lot and doing flip books and all that kind of stuff. So at some point it segued into, you know, live action, but it was always just a factor of what I was watching at that time.
The film stars Miles Teller as the music student, and he's great, but it's J.K. Simmons who steals the show. This is not teddy bear dad J.K. Simmons from Juno, or even irritable J. Jonah Jameson J.K. Simmons from the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movies. This is HBO Oz J.K. Simmons. This is terrifying prison inmate J.K. Simmons.
Why do you suppose I just hurled a chair at your head, Neiman?
I don't know.
Sure you do.
The tempo?
Were you rushing or were you dragging?
I don't know.
Start counting.
5, 6, 7.
In 4, damn it! Look at me!
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Now, was I rushing or was I dragging?
I don't know.
Count again.
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Rushing or dragging?
Rushing.
So you do know the difference!
That character was such a kind of composite of actual people, conductor I'd had personally, also Buddy Rich and his days as a band leader, and other kind of famously tyrannical band leaders. It was just sort of a kind of composite character that didn't correspond to any one actor. All I knew was that I wanted an actor where there would be some level of surprise to it. And what was fun about J.K. was that it was the perfect sort of – lately he'd been doing much more kind of kinder, supporting sort of father kind of roles or comic roles.
Right.
And I often tried to kind of use the analogy to people of like that I wanted the role to feel like, you know, when you see Ben Kingsley in Sexy Beast and you're kind of like, oh, Gandhi is going off the rails. What is going on?
No, 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 no. No, 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 no.
You've said like filmmaking, the process has its pros and cons. Could you tell me what they are?
When I think about like a lot of the experience of making Whiplash, a lot of it was, and I think this applies to any movie, but especially to a movie like this where you're trying to, you know, accomplish a lot in a very little amount of time. It becomes a constant kind of running against the clock. And that's just something that doesn't really apply to a lot of other art forms. You know, the urgency that's on screen in the final version of Whiplash was due maybe to the urgency that went into making it in the sense of the kind of crazy stress of actually making it. So I don't know. Maybe it wasn't a movie that should have been made in a kind of luxurious sort of vacuum, which it certainly wasn't. But the so it's almost simultaneously a pro and a con. But that's where you're really lucky to just have, you know, a really good AD, a really good DP, just good. You wind up being really just reliant on you're only as good as the crew you surround yourself with.
Uh-huh.
And that made it possible.
That was Damien Chazelle talking to Studio 360's Sean Ramos for him. You can hear their full conversation at studio360.org/sideshow. And while you're there, you can also subscribe to the podcast. Like that over-the-top music teacher in Whiplash, we at Studio 360 are also in the business of being creatively demanding slash inspiring. At the beginning of every year, we ask you to tell us about some creative project that you're dying to finally get done. And then we pick a few listeners to check in with all year long. This year, we're following a movie digital effects artist who wants to get back into calligraphy, a young man making a web comedy about his life, and an Ohio mom turned reggae DJ, and Karis Stiles, who is here with me on the line right now. Hello, Karis.
Hello.
So where am I reaching you?
So I'm in Oakland, California.
What do you do for a living?
I manage a suicide hotline for older adults.
Wow, that sounds potentially fulfilling but draining.
Absolutely, yeah. It's you know, dealing with crisis calls all day long and even sometimes in the overnight hours. So it's a pretty heavy-duty job, but yeah, it's really fulfilling and rewarding work.
So your creative resolution for this year is what?
So I want to make a diorama a month. So some size, some shape, some like little 3D box every single month.
Why dioramas?
You know, they're just kind of a unique and fun little project. I do a lot of collage work, but 2D paper wasn't really doing it. So I one day just tried a diorama based on a suggestion from my hairdresser.
Excellent. Yeah. So you're going to do one a month. January is over now. Have you finished your first one?
I did. Yeah, it was a teeny tiny one that I used from my new iPhone box that the phone came in.
What does it look like?
Well, some of the themes I want to explore throughout the year are taking kind of spiritual elements and themes and being really playful and silly with them. And so I wanted to do like a reinterpretation of one of these tarot cards called Strength. So it's this cat body with this hunky guy's head on it smoking a cigar, I think. And there's like this gold antler-looking thing, seaweed antler-looking thing that I took from a trophy I had from high school.
And are you, given that you got to do this every month, do you collect little stuff and put them aside for the sort of diorama material bin?
Yeah. I'm really cheap when it comes to supplies, so it's pretty much like found items.
Oh, well, good. That's a good parameter. Do you consider these works of art, or what do you call them?
I don't really know. I think they're more craft than art. As I said, it's not like I'm using a lot of special techniques. You know, I really think of like Joseph Cornell, who uh-huh. you know, made like a lot of dioramas, essentially, and I don't know if he called them that. But
I don't think so.
Yeah. But they were essentially dioramas that are yeah. these famous works of art. And of course, mine is nothing close to that, but I want to be able to do some things that are maybe a little bit more sophisticated with them.
Well, I'm all for the unpretentiousness of not calling them art, but they sound like art to me. And once you have, all going well, 12 done, do you have any end game, a show of them or anything?
This is really pushing me out of my comfort zone as far as just sharing pictures of them
yep.
outside of my little friend group.
Yep.
So we'll see if I can get the courage up to do some kind of end-of-the-year show, or maybe there'll be 12 of them, so maybe a calendar of them.
Good idea. Well, we will be back in touch and see how you're doing.
Great. Thank you so much.
Well, great talking to you. You can see some of Karis's dioramas at studio360.org. I want to give a giant thank you to everybody who told us about their resolutions for 2015. We heard from hundreds of you. And although we can't officially follow everybody, we do want to stay in touch. So we started a Facebook group. Tackling an ambitious project on top of work and kids and life is hard. We know that. And everybody can use some encouragement and advice. So look for Studio 360's Creative New Year's Resolutioners on Facebook. Or you can find out what you need to know at studio360.org. Still ahead this hour, I'll have some fun with Kate Pearson of the B-52s.
We said, you know, as long as this is fun, we'll still do it, and we're still doing it.
Kate Pearson performs live later this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Some things in life, no matter what, are just kind of a drag. If you're getting W-2s or 1099s in the mail around now, you know the kind of thing I'm talking about. But there are also things that maybe don't have to be so grim and unpleasant, like changing the cat litter, or like a lot of meetings at work, and everything associated with medical insurance. And that may make them all a job for Ingrid Fattel. She's a designer and design researcher with the international firm IDEO, and she also writes a blog called Aesthetics of Joy. The blog focuses on what a lot of design seems to be overlooking, how to bring some joy to joyless places.
What I'm hoping to do with the Aesthetics of Joy is actually create principles that are informed by what the cognitive sciences are showing us about the way that objects, surfaces, colors, textures, patterns make us feel, and use those as principles for designing things that make us really feel good.
How did you get interested in this as a paradigm, as an idea?
So I'm trained as a designer, but I work as a design researcher, which is really about observing the way that people interact with design. And it came from observing that there are certain objects that seem the world over to make people feel a sense of joy. You look at, you know, confetti is always present at festivals, and there are lanterns and, you know, balloons and bubbles and certain things that float and fly. And there are certain patterns that seem universal. And it was really born out of a curiosity to understand why. Why are there certain things that make, you know, even babies smile, because that seems like it could be really powerful because it's tapping into something that's not conscious and sometimes not even voluntary.
Right. So what are some examples of bringing joy into designed places or processes?
We're actually seeing artists do a lot of this work by going into depressed areas and actually painting, you know, the houses in slums. So, for example, Haas and Han are a pair of artists that have gone into slums in Brazil and painted all of the buildings in vibrant colors to make people feel a sense of pride in their community, a sense of joy, and a sense that their place matters.
You make me think of this politician, maybe a mayor in Albania.
Yes.
Who's all about that as well.
Edi Rama, yeah, who won the World Mayor's Award for what he did in Tirana. And he painted all of the building, a whole range of buildings, both public and private. He found that people actually started paying their taxes after the painting. Yeah, people stopped littering as much. And actually the shopkeepers started taking the sort of metal grates off their windows and opening glass window fronts back out to the street. And people said the streets felt safer, even though he had no money to increase the police force. But people said it felt safer.
So give people an example of some everyday experience they might suggest into which you will inject some joy.
Well, I think you can see the difference between what a joyless place feels like and what a joyful place feels like by thinking about the difference between an airplane cabin and thinking about maybe a music festival, right? So you have two environments where people are often crammed in. They're crammed in close together. But in an airplane—
With strangers.
With strangers. And in an airplane, everyone's cramped together, and they're fighting over, like, the last little piece of armrest, and you're in this sort of cold, a little bit clammy, sort of flimsy feeling, jangly environment. And then—
And crowded.
And crowded. But likewise, you could be at a festival and you're surrounded by, you know, lights, and you have people sort of sharing. You have people dancing with each other. You have people offering things from their picnic blankets, for example, to each other. And the vibe is completely different, even though people are crammed in just as much.
Well, we're going to try to open this process up a little bit to everybody. Listeners, we want your ideas for something that you find unnecessarily joyless. We will pick one of your suggestions, and then Ingrid and the absolutely crack team that she's assembled at IDEO will come back to us with a design proposal and prototype for making it more joyful. So, Ingrid, as people think about this, what should they keep in mind with their suggestions?
Think about the moments in your day that you wish would go faster. Think about also the places that you leave and you feel drained and you don't even know why.
Ingrid Fattel, thank you so much for doing this. I'm really looking forward to it.
Oh, you're welcome. Happy to be here.
Ingrid Fattel is a design director at IDEO. So what joyless experience or place or thing do you want to see redesigned by IDEO? Tell us about it at studio360.org/bringjoy or tweet us with a photo using the hashtag bringjoy. And speaking of going for the joy, there is no band that's done that more consistently than the B-52s. You don't really mistake a B-52 song for anything else. The sheer energy and glee of their music. Fred Schneider's bark-like singing voice. And the harmony sung by two women with perfect 1960s bouffant hairdos, Cindy Wilson and Kate Pearson. Pearson, the redhead, has also sung on records with artists like Iggy Pop and R.E.M. But only now, after four decades of music making, has she put out her first solo record. It's called Guitars and Microphones, and she is here with her band to perform some songs for us and talk. Kate Pearson, welcome to Studio 360.
Hi, Kurt. Glad to be here.
Happy to have you here. So you have been performing with the B-52s for going on 40 years.
Not quite 40 years.
But
don't add time.
The anniversary's coming up. I know.
It's moving fast enough.
What made you decide, time for a Kate Pearson record?
Oh, I just want to work more.
Yeah?
No. The band is actually, B-52s are taking a break. So this opened up this window of opportunity, and it's also been something I've wanted to do all my life.
Really?
I tried to do it maybe 12 years ago. I got together a whole set of songs and performed them and did a little tour. I did a whole record in Japan with a band called Nina.
Uh-huh.
And toured in Japan. And
so this is a long slog to get here.
It's been a long slog, and it's finally coming out, and I'm really thrilled
to
be doing this.
Well, I'm happy you have, because it's a really good record.
Thank you.
Will you play a song from it to begin?
Yes, we will.
And you'll play?
Bottoms Up.
Excellent.
Matchstick lies, hypnotized, silk-pinned eyes, and oral fixations, letters home while you roam. Clutch the past, taste the sedation, throw to the wind your addiction to friction and fiction. Ride through the night, risk your life.
was Kate Pearson of the B-52s performing Bottoms Up from her own new album, Guitars and Microphones. So, Kate, can you introduce this band?
Oh, yes. We just kind of met not too long ago, and we were doing a benefit called Ladies of the Valley up in Woodstock, which is we're all from the Hudson Valley. Well, we all live in Hudson Valley. And so this smoking young band, like, they're so great. And Monica and I, my partner Monica and I, we've been practicing guitar all winter, trying to play these songs, thinking, oh, we're going to play these. You know, maybe we have to play them ourselves, just, you know, Monica and me, and get a drummer. And then we realized the folly of that.
Yes.
And we decided, wow, we need these guys to play with us. So do you guys want to shout out your own names, or do you want to?
My name is Connor Kennedy on the guitar.
Brandon Morrison on the bass.
Will Bryant on the keys.
I'm Lee Falco on the drums.
So these, as you say, is this hot new young band. Not the people you've been playing with for almost 40 years. It must be entirely different, sort of getting to know each other musically and otherwise.
You know, it's weird. We were hanging out at our studio up in Woodstock, and we were in the kitchen and just talking between, you know, rehearsals. And I found out that, you know, they're mostly like 20. And I didn't feel any kind of age gap. And I thought, am I... You know, it's weird to feel like I'm maybe a 20-year-old boy at heart or something, but it's a refreshing. It's almost like when we started with the B-52s. It's like, whoa, this is like really fun doing new songs. And
You collaborated on writing the songs with the Australian singer and producer Sia.
Oh, yeah.
Who also produced the record, right?
She's executive producer.
Executive producer.
Tim Anderson produced the record.
And she has written songs for people like Beyonce and how did you
Rihanna.
And Rihanna, every famous single-named female singer in America today. How did you two start working together?
Well, none of this would have happened if it hadn't been for my partner, Monica, who really got this whole thing going.
Really? Huh.
I've always wanted to do the solo album, and as I said, I tried, you know, and wrote all these songs. And she mentioned to Sia, who was our friend for a while, and she said, can you help Kate get this started? And she said, yes, I can. And
Monica is your partner in every
sense.
In
everything, yes.
Yeah.
And but anyway, she mentioned to Sia, can you help Kate? And she said, yes.
Had you ever done that before, been in this process of songwriting in that fashion?
Well, the B-52s write collaboratively. Uh-huh. We write almost every song together, which is very unusual. I don't know of any other band that does it so collectively.
Yeah.
And, you know, we jam and jam and jam for hours at
Love Shack. So you were kind of, it was a familiar process.
Exactly. Yeah, collaboration is a thing I do.
Yeah. When the B-52s emerged in my youth in the late 70s, you pretty much single-handedly invented a kind of new subgenre, at least, of new wave. I want to play a track off the second B-52 album. This is a song called Private Idaho. Now, I remember 1980 very clearly, and this was such a new thing, this retro, kitschy thing. Today, music is so drenched in the old and in nostalgia, right. We sometimes don't even realize it's that. Talk about how you came up with the sort of conceptual idea of B-52's music and the sound and what influenced you.
Well, it wasn't a concept. I mean, we never sat down to conceptualize together.
Yeah. I'll have big hair and she'll... No, no.
I mean, Keith Strickland thought of the name, the B-52s, which was our nickname for a big bullet-shaped kind of nose cone, bomb-shaped hairdo. That was still very much in vogue in Athens, Georgia at that time. And we used to crash parties together and kind of hang out. And then one day we had a Flaming Volcano drink at Hunan's Chinese restaurant, and we went to jam at our friend's house, and we wrote this crazy song called Killer Bees, which we never did record. But, you know, we decided to wear wigs, and I had really long hair, and we went to Laverne, this hairdresser, who teased our hair up, and we wore fake pocketbooks on our head for our first performance, fake fun fur. I mean, they were fun fur pocketbooks.
And were you already kind of dressing and looking that way, or was this just all out of your heads, we're going to do this?
It was just for fun. It was just like kind of what we did, an extension of what we did for parties, like just wear crazy clothes. Uh-huh. And we were influenced by 60s Vogue magazine when Diana Vreeland was the editor, Fellini, you know, just kind of crazy stuff.
And musically?
Musically, we had such eclectic taste. We listened. There was a great music library at the University of Georgia. Uh-huh. So we listened to African music and Prez Prado and a lot of dance music and surf music and everything, you know, influenced us.
It seems like, I
Ima
mean, just
Sumac, Yoko Ono, sorry.
There were other new wave bands at the time being quirky and ironic in different ways. I'm thinking, speaking of Art School, for instance, of Talking Heads. But you guys were more about, it seems to me, fun than some of the other arty new wave bands.
Yeah, I mean, I think Talking Heads had such a sense of humor, too, and so did Devo, too, and Blondie. There was also kind of a lightness, you know, and sense of humor to those first kind of wave of punk kind of things. And we happened to land in that new wave genre, and we were like, what is new wave? You know, they just made up that term.
It's
you know?
The postmodern of music.
Exactly.
Do you think the fact that you were from the South had a big shaping influence on your music?
Well, Fred and I are both from New Jersey.
Wow, that's not a New Jersey accent, I hear.
No, I don't know. I never really had a...
But living in the South even, no?
Yes, there's something about Athens. I moved down there to just do a back to the land thing, and I lived in this funky little shack without, you know, any hot water, without any water.
As a hippie?
Yes, I was a hippie. I was a back-to-the-land, kind of doing a back-to-the-land thing when we all got together. But I think the influence of Athens, there was not the scene there then, not a creative scene.
Even with the university, even with the art school?
The art school for sure. But there wasn't really a music thing happening.
So you were it.
We started sort of, you know, I mean, obviously George's got incredible musicians, but there wasn't this kind of new kind of band thing happening in Athens.
REM hadn't been broken yet.
Not yet, no.
So three of the four of you were gay. Fred Schneider, flamboyantly so, as your front man. Did you think of yourself, even though this wasn't a phrase in 1976, as a queer band?
No, we didn't think of ourselves as a queer band. We just thought of ourselves as just plain queer.
In the sense of eccentric?
Eccentric, yes, yes. I mean, we were all had our own kind of wacky, you know, I hate to use that term, but, you know, it's always applied to the B-52s. But we all had our sensibility. We had a very similar sensibility, but we all brought our own kind of craziness to it, And, you know, it was just like a five-headed monster when we got together. It just gelled. There's something, you know, just about all of us coming together that created this sort of genie in a bottle blend that just, when it exploded, it was just unique. And it was really unique from any other band,
I think.
And
so what looked fun, you were actually having fun?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, good. That's good to know. I hate to be disappointed.
No, we said, you know, as long as this is fun, we'll still do it, and we're still doing it.
And by the time Love Shack became a big hit in 1989, the mainstream audiences who embraced that, a lot of them probably had no awareness of the kind of cultural origins that you had mixed up, right? I mean, campy, bohemian, 60s retro. they probably just, you know, took it on, and this fringe thing became a mainstream thing.
Yeah, it was like that was almost a new beginning. I mean, after Ricky died, we didn't feel like we could continue, and so we took a time off. And then we started feeling like, wow, life is so precious and we really ought to come back together again and also honor Ricky's memory by coming together. I mean, it sort of conjured his presence again and Cosmic Thing became this kind of a lot of songs about Athens. And so, you know, I think it was like you could see when we played, people that reacted to the new songs, you know, all of a sudden it was like, oh, yeah, Love Shack.
Yeah. And as I was looking back and thinking, you had just turned 40. That must have felt really good. Like, hey, I'm 40, but look, we've got this gigantic pop hit.
Yeah. Oh, the whole thing was just a roller coaster because we started out just doing this just to get as a healing process to do Cosmic Thing. It's like, let's get back together. And just write, and we consciously said, we don't care if this gets played on the radio. We don't care if it's a hit. We're just going to do it. And all these great songs just poured out, you know. And so we started touring again, and we started playing clubs, and then it started getting really, you know, hot. And then we started playing bigger places, and then we went round the country, round and round for like a year and a half we toured.
Yeah. second act, maybe even bigger than the first act.
Yes.
And so as a kid in New Jersey, when did you start singing and how?
I started singing when I was born. But no, I really always wanted to be a singer. That's all I wanted to do. And my father was a guitar player in a big band for a while when he was younger. And then when he got married, he always continued to play guitar at home. So I used to sit on his knee and strum the guitar. And I had a folk protest band in high school called the Sun Donuts. We wrote all our own protest songs.
In like the early 60s at the protest, folk protest
yes,
moment?
Yeah.
Yeah,
sort
wow.
of mid-60s. And
and when, as in the 60s, you decide, I'm going to go to Georgia, was that part of the romantic idea that I'm going to be among this old rootsy Americana music?
Not really. It was sort of the hand of fate that brought me to Athens.
Uh-huh.
I traveled through Europe after college. I went to BU, Boston University, and then I decided, well, I have to get out of America because it was Kent State, and I just thought, I have to leave this place. And so I went to Europe, and I traveled around for about 2 years, and I met my future ex-husband, Brian Cocaine, and he worked on a fishing boat, and we decided, anyway, a long story short, we wound up going back to America, and we met some people who were driving to Georgia, to Athens. So we said, okay, let's go to Athens.
You really are like a poster girl for baby boomers.
Really?
You had every step of the way you touched. Kate Pearson, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And before you go, will you play us out with a song?
Yes, we will.
What will this be?
This will be Bring Your Arms.
You can see a video of Kate and her band playing here at studio360.org. That's it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. By the way, if you've got an embryonic creative project you're excited about, join that new Facebook group we've made to share your goals, your quandaries, your MO, and cheer on your fellow makers. Just search on Facebook for Studio 360's Creative New Year's Resolutioners. And finally, don't forget, on Oscar night, come play bingo with us during the awards broadcast. You can get your own interactive bingo card at studio360.org/bingo. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
Matt Fidler,
Sean Ramisferum,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Krista Ripple,
Kasia Pila,
Kate Gill,
Rhiannon Corby,
Kayla Hoke.
Special thanks this week to Irene Trudell, and thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Yes, we are running with a lifeboat. I'm on a track through the tortoise head, transmitting what a trip, carrying the cries of a cotton carb.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, how did a self-sacrificing hero become the traitor to his race?
There aren't too many people that I know of, outside of a Martin Luther King, who would put their life on the line like that for other people.
Uncle Tom's Cabin, from our series American Icons, that's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.